The first stop was Modena, 30 minutes into the trip. As they entered the city, Marco decided to take stock of the faces behind him. He stood and made his way to the rear, to the restroom, and along the way gave a casual glance to each male. When he locked himself in the restroom, he closed his eyes and said to himself, "Yes, I've seen that face before." Less than 24 hours earlier, in Cafe Atene, just a few minutes before the lights went out, the face had been in a long mirror that lined the wall with an old coat rack above the tables. The face had been seated nearby, behind him, with another man. It was a familiar face. Maybe he'd even seen it before somewhere in Bologna. Marco returned to his seat as the bus slowed and approached the station. "Think quickly, man," he kept telling himself, "but keep your cool. Don't panic. They followed you out of Bologna. You can't let them follow you out of the country." As the bus stopped, the driver announced their arrival in Modena. A brief stop, a departure in 15 minutes. Four passengers waddled down the aisle and got off. The others kept their seats. Most were dozing anyway. Marco closed his eyes and allowed his head to drift to his left against the window. Fast asleep now. A minute passed, and two peasants climbed aboard, wild-eyed and clutching heavy cloth bags. When the driver returned and was situating himself behind the wheel, Marco suddenly eased from his seat, slid quickly along the aisle, and hopped off the bus just as the door was closing. He walked quickly into the station, then turned around and watched the bus back away. His pursuer was still on board. Crater's first move was to sprint off the bus, perhaps arguing with the driver in the process, but then no driver will fight to keep someone on board. He caught himself, though, because Marco obviously knew he was being followed. His last-second exit only confirmed what Crater had suspected. It was Marco, all right, running like a wounded animal. Problem was, he was loose in Modena, and Crater was not. The bus turned onto another street, then stopped for a traffic light. Crater rushed to the driver, holding his stomach, begging to get off before he vomited all over the place. The door flew open, Crater jumped off, and ran back toward the station. Marco wasted no time. When the bus was out of sight, he hurried to the front of the station where three taxis were lined up. He jumped into the back seat of the first one and said, "Can you take me to Milano?" His Italian was very good.
"Milano? Sì, Milano. È molto caro?"
"It's very expensive."
"Quanto?" €200.
€200. "Andiamo." After an hour of scouring the Modena bus station and the two streets next to it, Crater called Luigi with the news that was not all good and not all bad. He had lost his man, but the mad dash for freedom confirmed that it was indeed Marco. Luigi's reaction was mixed. He was frustrated that Crater had been outfoxed by an amateur. He was impressed that Marco could effectively change his appearance and elude a small army of assassins. And he was angry at Whitaker and the fools in Washington, who kept changing the plans and had now created an impending disaster for which he, Luigi, would no doubt get the blame. He called Whitaker, yelled and cursed some more, then headed for the train station with Zelman and the two others. They'd meet up with Crater in Milano, where Whitaker was promising a full court press with all the muscle he could pull in. Leaving Bologna on the direct Eurostar, Luigi had a wonderful idea, one he could never mention. Why not just simply call the Israelis and the Chinese and tell them that Bachmann was last seen in Modena, headed west to Parma and probably Milano? They wanted him much more than Langley did, and they could certainly do a better job of finding him. But orders were orders, even though they kept changing. All roads led to Milano. Chapter 29. The cab stopped a block away from the Milano Central train station. Marco paid the driver, thanked him more than once, wished him well back home in Modena, then walked past a dozen more taxis that were waiting for arriving passengers. Inside the mammoth station, he drifted with the crowd. up the escalators into the controlled frenzy of the platform area where a dozen tracks brought the trains. He found the departure board and studied his options. A train left for Stuttgart 4 times a day, and its 7th stop was Zurich. He picked up a schedule, bought a cheap city guide with a map, then found a table at a cafe among a row of shops. Time could not be wasted, but he needed to figure out where he was. He had 2 espressos and a pastry while his eyes watched the crowd. He loved the mob, the throng of people coming and going. There was safety in those numbers. His first plan was to take a walk, about 30 minutes, to the center of the city. Somewhere along the way, he would find an inexpensive clothing store and change everything: jacket, shirt, pants, shoes. They had spotted him in Bologna. He couldn't risk it again. Surely somewhere in the center of the city, near the Piazza del Duomo, there was an internet cafe where he could rent a computer for 15 minutes. He had little confidence in his ability to sit in front of a strange machine, turn the damn thing on, and not only survive the jungle of the internet, but get a message to Neil. It was 10:15 a.m. in Milan, 4:15 a.m. in Culpeper, Virginia. Neil would be checking in live at 7:50. Somehow, he'd make the email work. He had no choice. The second plan, the one that was looking better and better as he watched 1,000 people casually hop on trains that would have them scattered throughout Europe in a matter of hours, was to run. Buy a ticket right now and get out of Milano and Italy as soon as possible. His new hair color and Giovanni's eyeglasses and old professor's jacket had not fooled them in Bologna. If they were that good, they would surely find him anywhere. He compromised with a walk around the block. The fresh air always helped, and after 4 blocks his blood was pumping again. As in Bologna, the streets of Milano fanned out in all directions like a spider web. The traffic was heavy and at times hardly moved. He loved the traffic, and he especially loved the crowded sidewalks that gave him cover. The shop was called Roberto's, a small haberdashery wedged between a jewelry store and a bakery. The 2 front windows were packed with clothing that would hold up for about a week, which fit Marco's time frame perfectly. A clerk from the Middle East spoke worse Italian than Marco, but he was fluent in pointing and grunting, and he was determined to transform his customer. The blue jacket was replaced with a dark brown one. The new shirt was a white pullover with short sleeves. The slacks were low-grade wool, very dark navy. Alterations would take a week, so Marco asked the clerk for a pair of scissors. In the mildewy dressing room, he measured as best he could, then cut the pants off himself. When he walked out in his new ensemble, the clerk looked at the ragged edges where the cuffs should have been and almost cried. The shoes Marco tried on would have crippled him before he made it back to the train station, so he stayed with his hiking boots for the moment. The best purchase was a tan straw hat that Marco bought because he had seen one just before entering the store. What did he care about fashion at this point? The new getup cost him almost 400 euros, money he hated to part with, but he had no choice. He tried to swap Giovanni's briefcase, which was certainly worth more than everything he was wearing, but the clerk was too depressed over the butchered slacks. He was barely able to offer a weak thanks and goodbye. Marco left with the blue jacket, faded jeans, and the old shirt folded up in a red shopping bag. Again, something different to carry around. He walked a few minutes and saw a shoe store. He bought a pair of what appeared to be slightly modified bowling shoes, without a doubt the ugliest items in what turned out to be a very nice store. They were black with some manner of burgundy striping, hopefully built for comfort and not attractiveness. He paid 150 euros for them, only because they were already broken in. It took 2 blocks before he could muster the courage to look down at them. Luigi got himself followed out of Bologna. The kid on the scooter saw him leave the apartment next to Bachmann's, and it was the manner in which he left that caught his attention. He was jogging, and gaining speed with each step. No one runs under the porticos on Via Fondazza. The scooter hung back until Luigi stopped and quickly crawled into a red Fiat. He drove a few blocks, then slowed long enough for another man to jump into the car. They took off at breakneck speed, but in city traffic, the scooter had no trouble keeping up. When they wheeled into the train station and parked illegally, the kid on the scooter saw it all and radioed Ephraim again. Within 15 minutes, two Mossad agents dressed as traffic policemen entered Luigi's apartment, setting off alarms, some silent, some barely audible. While three agents waited on the street providing cover, the two inside kicked open the kitchen door and found the astounding collection of electronic surveillance equipment. When Luigi, Zelman, and a third agent stepped onto the Eurostar to Milano, the kid on the scooter had a ticket too. His name was Paul, the youngest member of the Kidam and the most fluent speaker of Italian. Behind the bangs and baby face was a 26-year-old veteran of half a dozen killings. When he radioed that he was on the train and it was moving, two more agents entered Luigi's apartment to help dissect the equipment. One alarm, though, could not be silenced. Its steady ring penetrated the walls just enough to attract attention from a few neighbors along the street. After 10 minutes, Ephraim called a halt to the break-in. The agents scattered, then regrouped in one of their safe houses. They had not been able to determine who Luigi was or who he worked for, but it was obvious he had been spying on Backman around the clock. As the hours passed with no sign of Backman, they began to believe that he had fled. Could Luigi lead them to him? In central Milano, at the Piazza del Duomo, Marco gawked at the mammoth Gothic cathedral that took only 300 years to complete. He strolled along the Galleria Vittorio Emanuele, the magnificent glass-domed gallery that Milano is famous for. Lined with cafes and bookshops, the gallery is the center of the city's life, its most popular meeting place. With the temperature approaching 60 degrees, Marco had a sandwich and a cola outdoors, where the pigeons swarmed every wayward crumb. He watched elderly Milanese stroll through the gallery, women arm in arm, men stopping to chat, as if time was irrelevant. To be so lucky, he thought. Should he leave immediately, or should he lay low for a day or two? That was the new urgent question. In a crowded city of 4 million people, he could vanish for as long as he wanted. He'd get a map, learn the streets, spend hours hiding in his room and hours walking the alleys. But the bloodhounds behind him would have time to regroup. Shouldn't he leave now, while they were back there scrambling and scratching their heads? Yes, he should, he decided. He paid the waiter and glanced down at his bowling shoes. They were indeed comfortable, but he couldn't wait to burn them. On a city bus, he saw an ad for an internet cafe on Via Veri. 10 minutes later, he entered the place. A sign on the wall gave the rates, €10 per hour, minimum of 30 minutes. He ordered an orange juice and paid for half an hour. The clerk nodded in the general direction of a table where a bunch of computers were waiting. Three of the eight were being used by people who obviously knew what they were doing. Marco was already lost. But he faked it well. He sat down, grabbed a keyboard, stared at the monitor, and wanted to pray, but plowed ahead as if he had been hacking for years. It was surprisingly easy. He went to the Quite Mail site, typed his username, Grinch456, then his passphrase, post hoc ergo propter hoc, waited 10 seconds, and there was the message from Neil. Marco, Mikkel van Tissen is still with Rhineland Bank, now the vice president of client services. Anything else, Grinch. At exactly 7:50 Eastern Standard Time, Marco typed a message. Grinch, Marco here, live and in person. Are you there? He sipped his juice and stared at the screen. Come on, baby, make this thing work. Another sip. A lady across the table was talking to her monitor. Then the message. I'm here, loud and clear. What's up? Marco typed, They stole my Ankyo 850. There's a good chance the bad guys have it and they're picking it to pieces. Any chance they can discover you? Neil. Only if they have the username and passphrase. Do they? Marco. No, I destroyed them. There's no way they can get around a password? Neil. Not with Quietmail. It's totally secure and encrypted. If they have the PC and nothing more, then they're out of luck. Marco. And we're completely safe now? Neil. Yes, absolutely. But what are you using now? Marco. I'm in an internet cafe renting a computer, like a real hacker. Neil. Do you want another Ankyo smartphone? Marco. No, not now. Maybe later. Here's the deal. Go see Carl Pratt. I know you don't like him, but at this point I need him. Pratt was very close to former Senator Ira Claiborne from North Carolina. Claiborne ruled the Senate Intelligence Committee for many years. I need Claiborne now. Go through Pratt. Neil. Where's Claiborne now? Marco. I don't know. I just hope he's still alive. He came from the Outer Banks of North Carolina, some pretty remote place. He retired the year after I went to federal camp. Pratt can find him. Neil. Sure, I'll do it as soon as I can sneak away. Marco. Please be careful. Watch your back. Neil. Are you okay? Marco. I'm on the run. I left Bologna this morning. I'll try to check in the same time tomorrow. Okay? Neil, keep your head down. I'll be here tomorrow. Marco signed off with a smug look. Mission accomplished. Nothing to it. Welcome to the age of high-tech wizardry and gadgetry. He made sure his exit was clean from Quietmail, then finished his orange juice and left the cafe. He headed in the direction of the train station, stopping first at a leather shop, where he managed an even swap of Giovanni's fine briefcase for a black one of patently inferior quality. Then at a cheap jewelry store, where he paid 18 euros for a large round-faced watch with a bright red plastic band, something else to distract anyone looking for Marco Lazzari, formerly of Bologna. Then at a used bookshop, where he spent 2 euros on a well-worn hardback containing the poetry of Czesław Miłosz. All in Polish, of course, anything to confuse the bloodhounds. And finally, at a second-hand accessory store, where he bought a pair of sunglasses and a wooden cane, which he began using immediately on the sidewalk. The cane reminded him of Francesca. It also slowed him down, changed his gait. With time to spare, he shuffled into Milano Centrale and bought a ticket for Stuttgart. Whitaker got the urgent message from Langley that Luigi's safe house had been broken into, but there was absolutely nothing he could do about it. All the agents from Bologna were now in Milano, scrambling frantically. Two were at the train station, looking for the needle in the haystack. Two were at Malpensa Airport, 27 miles from downtown. Two were at Linate Airport, which was much closer and handled primarily European flights. Luigi was at the central bus station, still arguing by cell phone that perhaps Marco wasn't even in Milano. Just because he took the bus from Bologna to Modena and headed in the general direction of northwest didn't necessarily mean he was going to Milano. But Luigi's credibility at the moment was somewhat diminished, at least in Whitaker's substantial opinion, so he was banished to the bus station where he watched 10,000 people come and go. Crater got closest to the needle. For 60 euros, Marco purchased a first-class ticket in hopes that he could avoid the exposure of traveling by coach. For the ride north, the first-class car was the last one, and Marco climbed aboard at 5:30, 45 minutes before departure. He settled into his seat, hid his face as much as possible behind the sunglasses and the tan straw hat, opened the book of Polish poetry, and gazed out at the platform where passengers walked by his train. Some were barely 5 feet away, all in a hurry. Except one. The guy on the bus was back. The face from Cafe Atene, probably the sticky-fingered thug who had grabbed his blue Silvio bag. The same bloodhound who'd been a step too slow off the bus in Modena about 11 hours ago. He was walking, but not going anywhere. His eyes were squinted, his forehead wrinkled in a deep frown. For a professional, he was much too obvious, thought Giovanni Ferro, who unfortunately now knew much more than he wanted to know about ducking and hiding and covering tracks. Crater had been told that Marco would probably head either south to Rome, where he had more options, or north to Switzerland, Germany, France, virtually the entire continent to choose from. For 5 hours, Crater had been strolling along the 12 platforms, watching as the trains came and went, mixing with the crowds, not concerned at all with who was getting off, but paying desperate attention to who was getting on. Every blue jacket of any shade or style got his attention, but he had yet to see one with the worn elbow patches. It was in the cheap black briefcase wedged between Marco's feet in seat number 70 of the first-class car to Stuttgart. Marco watched Crater amble along the platform, paying very close attention to the train whose final destination was Stuttgart. He was holding what appeared to be a ticket, and as he walked out of sight, Marco could swear that he got on the train. Marco fought the urge to get off. The door to his cabin opened, and Madame entered. Chapter 30. Once it was determined that Bachmann had disappeared and was not finally dead at the hands of someone else, a frenetic 5 hours passed before Julia Javier found the information that should have been close by. It was found in a file that had been locked away in the director's office and once guarded by Teddy Maynard himself. If Julia had ever seen the information, she could not remember. And in the chaos, she was certainly not going to admit anything. The information had come reluctantly from the FBI years earlier when Bachmann was being investigated. His financial dealings were under great scrutiny because the rumors were wild that he had bilked a client and buried a fortune. So where was the money? In search of it, the FBI had been piecing together his travel history when he abruptly pled guilty and was sent away. The guilty plea didn't close the Bachmann file, but it certainly removed the pressure. With time, the travel research was completed and eventually sent over to Langley. In the month before Bachmann was indicted, arrested, and released on a very restricted bail arrangement, he had made two quick trips to Europe. For the first one, he had flown Air France business class with his favorite secretary to Paris, where they frolicked for a few days and saw the sights. She later told investigators that Bachmann had spent one long day dashing off to Berlin for some quick business, but made it back in time for dinner at Alain Ducasse. She did not accompany him. There were no records of Bachmann traveling by a commercial airliner to Berlin or anywhere else within Europe during that week. A passport would have been required, and the FBI was positive he had not used his. A passport would not have been required for a train ride. Geneva, Bern, Lausanne, and Zurich are all within 4 hours of Paris by train. The second trip was a 72-hour sprint from Dulles. First class on Lufthansa to Frankfurt, again for business, though no business contacts had been discovered there. Bachmann had paid for 2 nights in a luxury hotel in Frankfurt, and there was no evidence that he had slept elsewhere. Like Paris, the banking centers of Switzerland are within a few hours' train ride from Frankfurt. When Julia Javier finally found the file and read the report, she immediately called Whitaker and said, "He's headed for Switzerland." Madame had enough luggage for an affluent family of five. A harried porter helped her haul the heavy suitcases on board and into the first-class car, which she consumed with herself, her belongings, and her perfume. The cabin had 6 seats, at least 4 of which she laid claim to. She sat in one across from Marco and wiggled her ample rear as if to make it expand. She glanced at him cowering against the window and gushed over a sultry bonsoir. French, he thought. And since it didn't seem right to respond in Italian, he relied on Old Faithful. Hello?
Ah, American.
With languages, identities, names, cultures, backgrounds, lies, and more lies all swirling around, he managed to say with no conviction whatsoever, "No, Canadian."
Ah, yes,
she said, still arranging bags and settling in. Evidently, American would have been more welcome than Canadian. Madame was a robust woman of 60 with a tight red dress, thick calves, and stout black pumps that had traveled 1 million miles. Her heavily decorated eyes were puffy, and the reason was soon evident. Long before the train moved, she pulled out a large flask, unscrewed its top, which became a cup, and knocked back a shot of something strong. She swallowed hard, then smiled at Marco and said,
"Would you like a drink?"
"No, thanks."
"It's very good brandy."
"No, thanks."
"Very well."
She poured another one, drained it, then put away the flask. A long train ride just got longer.
"Where are you going?" she asked in very good English.
"Stuttgart. And you?"
"Stuttgart. Then on to Strasbourg. Can't stay too long in Stuttgart, you know."
Her nose wrinkled as if the entire city was swimming in raw sewage. "I love Stuttgart," Marco said, just to watch it unwrinkle.
"Oh, well."
Her shoes caught her attention. She kicked them off with little regard as to where they might land. Marco braced for a jolt of foot odor, but then realized it had little chance of competing with the cheap perfume. In self-defense, he pretended to nod off. She ignored him for a few minutes, then said loudly,
"You speak Polish?"
She was looking at his book of poetry. He jerked his head as if he had just been awakened.
"No, not exactly. I'm trying to learn it, though. My family is Polish."
He held his breath as he finished, half expecting her to unleash a torrent of proper Polish and bury him with it.
"I see,"
she said, not really approving. At exactly 6:15, an unseen conductor blew a whistle and the train started to move. Fortunately, there were no other passengers assigned to Madame's car. Several had walked down the aisle and stopped, glanced in, seen the congestion, then moved on to another cabin where there was more room. Marco watched the platform intensely as they began moving. The man from the bus was nowhere to be seen. Madame worked the brandy until she began snoring. She was awakened by the conductor who punched their tickets. A porter came through with a pushcart loaded with drinks. Marco bought a beer and offered one to his cabin mate. His offer was greeted with another mammoth wrinkle of the nose, as if she had rather drink urine. Their first stop was Como San Giovanni, a 2-minute break during which no one got on. 5 minutes later, they stopped at Chiasso. It was almost dark now, and Marco was pondering a quick exit. He studied the itinerary. There were 4 more stops before Zurich, 1 in Italy and 3 in Switzerland. Which country would work best? He couldn't risk being followed now. If they were on the train, then they had stuck to him from Bologna through Modena and Milano through various disguises. They were professionals, and he was no match for them. Sipping his beer, Marco felt like a miserable amateur. Madame was staring at the butchered hems of his slacks. Then he caught her glancing down at the modified bowling shoes, and for that he didn't blame her at all. Then the bright red watch band caught her attention. Her face conveyed the obvious. She did not approve of his low sense of fashion. Typical American or Canadian or whatever he was. He caught a glimpse of lights shimmering off Lake Lugano. They were snaking through the lake region, gaining altitude. Switzerland was not far away. An occasional drifter moved down the darkened aisle outside their cabin.
They would look in through the glass door, then move along toward the rear, where there was a restroom. Madame had plopped her large feet in the seat opposite her, not too far from Marco. An hour into the trip, and she had managed to spread her boxes and magazines and clothing throughout the entire cabin. Marco was afraid to leave his seat. Fatigue finally set in, and Marco fell asleep. He was awakened by the racket at the Bellinzona station, the first stop in Switzerland. A passenger entered the first-class car and couldn't find the right seat. He opened the door to Madame's cabin, looked around, didn't like what he saw, then went off to yell at the conductor. They found him a spot elsewhere. Madame hardly looked up from her fashion magazines. The next stretch was an hour and 40 minutes, and when Madame went back to her flask, Marco said, "I'll try some of that." She smiled for the first time in hours. Though she certainly didn't mind drinking alone, it was always more pleasant with a friend. A couple of shots, though, and Marco was nodding off again. The train jerked as it slowed for the stop at Art Goldau. Marco's head jerked, too, and his hat fell off. Madame was watching him closely. When he opened his eyes for good, she said, "A strange man has been looking at you."
"Where?"
"Where? Here, of course, on this train. He's been by at least three times. He stops at the door, looks closely at you, then sneaks away."
"Maybe it's my shoes," thought Marco, "or my slacks. Watch band?"
He rubbed his eyes and tried to act as though it happened all the time. "What does he look like?"
"Blonde hair, about 35. Cute. Brown jacket. Do you know him?"
"No, I have no idea." The man on the bus at Modena had neither blonde hair nor a brown jacket, but those minor points were irrelevant now. Marco was frightened enough to switch plans. Zug was 25 minutes away, the last stop before Zurich. He could not run the risk of leading them to Zurich. 10 minutes out, he announced he needed to use the restroom. Between his seat and the door was Madame's obstacle course. As he began stepping through it, he placed his briefcase and cane in his seat. He walked past four cabins, each with at least three passengers, none of whom looked suspicious. He went to the restroom, locked the door, and waited until the train began to slow. Then it stopped. Zug was a 2-minute layover, and the train so far had been ridiculously on time. He waited 1 minute, then walked quickly back to his cabin, opened the door, said nothing to Madame, grabbed his briefcase and his cane, which he was perfectly prepared to use as a weapon, and raced to the rear of the train, where he jumped onto the platform. It was a small station, elevated with a street below. Marco flew down the steps to the sidewalk where a lone taxi sat, with a driver unconscious behind the wheel. "Hotel, please," he said, startling the driver, who instinctively grabbed the ignition key. He asked something in German, and Marco tried Italian. "I need a small hotel. I don't have a reservation."
"No problem," the driver said.
As they pulled away, Marco looked up and saw the train moving. He looked behind him and saw no one giving chase. The ride took all of 4 blocks, and when they stopped in front of an A-frame building on a quiet side street, the driver said in Italian,
"This hotel is very good."
"Looks fine, thanks. How far away is Zurich by car?"
2 hours, more or less. Depends on the traffic."
"Tomorrow morning, I need to be in downtown Zurich at 9 o'clock. Can you drive me there?" The driver hesitated for a second, his mind thinking of cold cash.
"Perhaps," he said.
"How much will it cost?" The driver rubbed his chin, then shrugged and said,
€200.
"Good. Let's leave here at 6.
"6, yes. I'll be here."
Marco thanked him again and watched as he drove away. A bell rang when he entered the front door of the hotel. The small counter was deserted, but a television was chattering away somewhere close by. A sleepy-eyed teenager finally appeared and offered a smile.
"Guten Abend," he said.
"Parla inglese?" Marco asked. He shook his head no.
"Italiano?"
"A little." "I speak a little too," Marco said in Italian. "I'd like a room for one night." The clerk pushed over a registration form. And from memory, Marco filled in the name on his passport and its number. He scribbled in a fictional address in Bologna and a bogus phone number as well. The passport was in his coat pocket close to his heart, and he was prepared to reluctantly pull it out. But it was late, and the clerk was missing his television show. With atypical Swiss inefficiency, he said, also in Italian, 42 euros, and didn't mention the passport. Giovanni laid the cash on the counter, and the clerk gave him a key to room number 26. In surprisingly good Italian, he arranged a wake-up call for 5 a.m. Almost as an afterthought, he said, I lost my toothbrush. Would you have an extra? The clerk reached into a drawer and pulled out a box full of assorted necessities. Toothbrushes, toothpaste, disposable razors, shaving cream, aspirin, tampons, hand cream, combs, even condoms. Giovanni selected a few items and handed over 10 euros. A luxury suite at the Ritz could not have been more welcome than room 26. Small, clean, warm, with a firm mattress and a door that bolted twice to keep away the faces that had been haunting him since early morning. He took a long, hot shower, then shaved and brushed his teeth forever. Much to his relief, he found a minibar in a cabinet under the television. He ate a packet of cookies, washed them down with two small bottles of whiskey, and when he crawled under the covers, he was mentally drained and physically exhausted. The cane was on the bed nearby. Silly, but he couldn't help it. Chapter 31. In the depths of prison, he had dreamed of Zurich, with its blue rivers and clean, shaded streets and modern shops and handsome people, all proud to be Swiss, all going about their business with a pleasant seriousness. In another life, he had ridden the quiet electric streetcars with them as they headed into the financial district. Back then, he had been too busy to travel much, too important to leave the fragile workings of Washington. But Zurich was one of the few places he'd seen. It was his kind of city, unburdened by tourists and traffic, unwilling to spend its time gawking at cathedrals and museums and worshiping the last 2,000 years. Not at all. Zurich was about money, the refined management of it as opposed to the naked cash grab Bachmann had once perfected. He was on a streetcar again, one he'd caught near the train station, and was now moving steadily along Bahnhofstrasse, the main avenue of downtown Zurich, if in fact it had one. It was almost 9 a.m. He was among the last wave of the sharply dressed young bankers headed for UBS and Credit Suisse and 1,000 lesser-known but equally rich institutions. Dark suits, shirts of various colors, but not many white ones, expensive ties with thicker knots and fewer designs, dark brown shoes with laces, never tassels. The styles had changed slightly in the past 6 years. Always conservative, but with some dash. Not quite as stylish as the young professionals in his native Bologna, but quite attractive. Everyone was reading something as they moved along. Streetcars passed from the other direction. Marco pretended to be engrossed in a copy of Newsweek, but he was really watching everyone else. No one was watching him. No one seemed offended by his bowling shoes. In fact, he'd seen another pair on a casually dressed young man near the train station. His straw hat was getting no attention. The hems of his slacks had been repaired slightly after he had purchased a cheap sewing kit from the hotel desk, then spent half an hour trying to tailor his pants without drawing blood. His outfit cost a fraction of those around him, but what did he care? He'd made it to Zurich without Luigi and all those others, and with a little more luck, he'd make it out. At Paradeplatz, the streetcars wheeled in from east and west and stopped. They emptied quickly as the young bankers scattered in droves and headed for the buildings. Marco moved with the crowd, his hat now left behind under the seat in the streetcar. Nothing had changed in 7 years. The Paradeplatz was still the same, an open plaza lined with small shops and cafes. The banks around it had been there for 100 years. Some announced their names from neon signs. Others were hidden so well they couldn't be found. From behind his sunglasses, he soaked in as much of the surroundings as he could while sticking close to three young men with gym bags slung over their shoulders. They appeared to be headed for Rhineland Bank on the east side. He followed them inside, into the lobby, where the fun began. The information desk hadn't moved in 7 years. In fact, the well-groomed lady sitting behind it looked vaguely familiar. "I'd like to see Mr. Mikkel von Tissen," he said as softly as possible.
"And your name?"
"Marco Lazzari." He would use Joel Backman later, upstairs, but he was hesitant to use it here. Hopefully Neil's emails to von Tissen had alerted him to the alias. The banker had been asked to remain in town, if at all possible, for the next week or so. She was on the phone and also pecking at a keyboard.
"It will be just a moment, Mr. Lazzari," she said. "Would you mind waiting?"
"No," he said. Waiting? He'd been dreaming of this for years. He took a chair, crossed his legs, saw the shoes, then put his feet under the chair. He was certain that he was being watched from a dozen different camera angles now, and that was fine. Maybe they would recognize Backman sitting in the lobby, maybe they wouldn't. He could almost see them up there, gawking at the monitors, scratching their heads, saying, "Don't know. He's much thinner, gaunt even. And the hair, it's obviously a bad coloring job." To help them, Joel removed Giovanni's tortoiseshell glasses. 5 minutes later, a stern-faced security type in a much lesser suit approached him from nowhere and said, "Mr. Lazzari, would you follow me?" They rode a private elevator up to the third floor where Marco was led into a small room with thick walls. All the walls seemed to be thick at Rhineland Bank. Two other security agents were waiting. One actually smiled, the other did not. They asked him to place both hands on a biometric fingerprint scanner. It would compare his fingerprints to the ones he left behind almost 7 years ago at this same place. And when the perfect match was made, there would be more smiles, then a nicer room, a nicer lobby, the offer of coffee or juice, anything, Mr. Backman. He asked for orange juice because he had had no breakfast. The security agents were back in their cave. Mr. Backman was now being serviced by Elke, one of Mr. von Tissen's shapely assistants.
"He'll be out in just a minute," she explained. "He wasn't expecting you this morning."
Kinda hard to make appointments when you're hiding in toilet stalls. Joel smiled at her. Old Marco was history now, finally laid to rest after a good 2 month run. Marco had served him well, kept him alive, taught him the basics of Italian, walked him around Treviso and Bologna, and introduced him to Francesca, a woman he would not soon forget. But Marco would also get him killed, so he ditched him there on the third floor of the Rhineland Bank while looking at Elke's black stiletto heels and waiting on her boss. Marco was gone, never to return. Mikkel von Tissen's office was designed to smack his visitors with a powerful right hook. Power in the massive Persian rug. Power in the leather sofa and chairs. Power in the ancient mahogany desk that wouldn't have fit in the cell at Rudley. Power in the array of electronic gadgets at his disposal. He met Joel at the powerful oak door, and they shook hands properly, but not like old friends. They had met exactly once before. If Joel had lost 60 pounds since their last visit, von Tissen had found most of it. He was much grayer, too, not nearly as crisp and sharp as the younger bankers Joel had seen on the streetcar. Von Tissen directed his client to the leather chairs while Elke and another assistant scurried around to fetch coffee and pastries. When they were alone with the door shut, von Tissen said, "I've been reading about you."
"Oh, really? And what have you read?"
"Bribing a president for a pardon. Come on, Mr. Backman. Is it really that easy over there?"
Joel couldn't tell if he was joking or not. Joel was in an upbeat mood, but he didn't exactly feel like swapping one-liners.
"I didn't bribe anyone, if that's what you're suggesting."
"Yes, well, the newspapers are certainly filled with speculation."
His tone was more accusatory than jovial, and Joel decided not to waste time.
Do you believe everything you read in the newspapers?
Of course not, Mr. Bachman.
I'm here for three reasons. I want access to my security box. I want to review my account. I want to withdraw $10,000 in cash. After that, I may have another favor or two.
Von Tissen shoved a small cookie in his mouth and chewed rapidly.
Yes, of course. I don't think we'll have a problem with any of that.
Why should you have a problem?
Not a problem, sir. I'll just need a few minutes.
For what?
I'll need to consult with a colleague.
Can you do so quickly?
Von Tissen practically bolted from the room and slammed the door behind him. The pain in Joel's stomach was not from hunger. If the wheels came off now, he had no plan B. He'd walk out of the bank with nothing, hopefully make it across the Parada Platz to a streetcar, and once on board, he would have no place to go. The escape would be over. Marco would be back, and Marco would eventually get him killed. As time came to an abrupt halt, he kept thinking about the pardon. With it, his slate was wiped clean. The U.S. government was in no position to pressure the Swiss to freeze his account. The Swiss didn't freeze accounts. The Swiss were immune from pressure. That's why their banks were filled with loot from around the world. They were the Swiss.
Elke retrieved him and asked if he would follow her downstairs. In other days, he would have followed Elke anywhere, but now it was only downstairs. He'd been to the vault during his prior visit. It was in the basement, several levels below ground, though the clients never knew how deep into the Swiss soil they were descending. Every door was a foot thick, every wall appeared to be made of lead, every ceiling had surveillance cameras. Elke handed him off to Von Tissen again. Both thumbs were scanned for matching prints. An optical scanner took his photo.
Number 7, Von Tissen said, pointing. I'll meet you there, he said, and left through a door.
Joel walked down a short hallway, passing 6 windowless steel doors, until he came to the 7th. He pushed a button, all sorts of things tumbled and clicked inside, and the door finally opened. He stepped inside where Von Tissen was waiting. The room was a 12-foot square with 3 walls lined with individual vaults, most about the size of a large shoebox.
Your vault number? He asked.
L2270.
Correct.
Von Tissen stepped to his right, bent slightly to face L2270. On the vault's small keypad, he punched some numbers, then straightened himself and said,
If you wish.
Under Von Tissen's watchful eyes, Joel stepped to his vault and entered the code. As he did so, he softly whispered the numbers forever seared in his memory.
81, 55, 94, 93, 23.
A small green light began blinking on the keypad. Von Tissen smiled and said,
I'll be waiting at the front. Just ring when you're finished.
When he was alone, Joel removed the steel box from his vault and pulled open the top. He picked up the padded mailing envelope and opened it. There were the 4 2-gigabyte jazz discs that had once been worth $1 billion. He allowed himself a moment, but no more than 60 seconds. He was, after all, very safe at that time, and if he wanted to reflect, what was the harm? He thought of Safi Mirza, Fazl Sharif, and Farouk Khan, the brilliant boys who'd discovered Neptune, then wrote reams of software to manipulate the system. They were all dead now, killed by their naive greed and their choice of lawyer. He thought of J.C. Hubbard, the brash, gregarious, infinitely charismatic crook who had snowed the voters for an entire career and finally gotten much too greedy. He thought of Carl Pratt and Kim Bowling and dozens of other partners he had brought into their prosperous firm, and the lives that had been wrecked by what he was now holding in his hand. He thought of Neil and the humiliation he had caused his son when the scandal engulfed Washington and prison became not only a certainty, but a sanctuary. And he thought of himself. Not in selfish terms, not in pity, not passing the blame to anyone else. What a miserable mess of a life he had lived, so far anyway. As much as he'd like to go back and do it differently, he had no time to waste on such thoughts. You've only got a few years left, Joel, or Marco, or Giovanni, or whatever the hell your name is. For the first time in your rotten life, why don't you do what's right as opposed to what's profitable? He put the discs in the envelope in his briefcase, then replaced the steel box in the vault. He rang for Von Tissen. Back in the power office, Von Tissen handed him a file with one sheet of paper in it. "This is a summary of your account," he was saying. "It's very straightforward. As you know, there's been no activity." "You guys are paying 1% interest," Joel said. "You were aware of our rates when you opened the account, Mr. Bachman." "Yes, I was." "We protect your money in other ways." "Of course." Joel closed the file and handed it back. "I don't want to keep this. Do you have the cash?" "Yes, it's on the way up." "Good. I need a few things." Von Tissen pulled over his writing pad and stood ready with his fountain pen. "Yes," he said. "I want to wire $100,000 to a bank in Washington, D.C. Can you recommend one?"
"Certainly.
We work closely with Maryland Trust." "Good. Wire the money there, and with the wire, open a generic savings account. I will not be writing checks, just making withdrawals."
"In what name?"
"Joel Bachman and Neil Bachman." He was getting used to his name again, not ducking when he said it, not cowering in fear, waiting for gunfire. He liked it.
"Very well," Von Tissen said. "Anything was possible."
"I need some help in getting back to the U.S. Could your girl check the Lufthansa flights to Philadelphia and New York?"
"Of course."
"When and from where?"
"Today, as soon as possible.
I'd like to avoid the airport here. How far away is Munich by car?"
"By car, 3 to 4 hours."
"Can you provide a car?"
"I'm sure we can arrange that."
"I prefer to leave from the basement here in a car driven by someone not dressed like a chauffeur. Not a black car, either. Something that will not attract attention."
Von Tissen stopped writing and shot a puzzled look. "Are you in danger, Mr. Bachman?"
"Perhaps. I'm not sure, and I'm not taking chances."
Von Tissen pondered this for a few seconds, then said, "Would you like for us to make the airline reservations?"
"Yes."
"Then I need to see your passport."
Joel pulled out Giovanni's borrowed passport. Von Tissen studied it for a long time, his stoic banker's face betraying him. He was confused and worried. He finally managed,
"Mr. Bachman, you will be traveling with someone else's passport?"
"That's correct."
"And this is a valid passport?"
"It is."
"I assume you do not have one of your own."
"They took it a long time ago."
"This bank cannot take part in the commission of a crime. If this is stolen, then..."
"I assure you, it's not stolen."
"Then how did..." "Let's just say it's borrowed, okay?
But using someone else's passport is a violation of the law."
"Let's not get hung up on U.S. immigration policy, Mr. Von Tissen. Just get the schedules. I'll pick the flights. Your girl makes the reservations using the bank's account. Deduct it from my balance. Get me a car and a driver. Deduct that from my balance if you wish. It's all very simple."
It was just a passport. Hell, other clients had 3 or 4 of them. Von Tissen handed it back to Joel and said,
"Very well. Anything else?"
"Yes, I need to go online. I'm sure your computers are secure."
"Absolutely."
His email to Neil read, "Grinch, with a bit of luck, I should arrive in U.S. tonight. Get a new cell phone today. Don't let it out of your sight. Tomorrow morning, call the Hilton, Marriott, and Sheraton in downtown Washington. Ask for Giovanni Ferro. That's me. Call Carl Pratt first thing this morning on the new phone. Push hard to get Senator Claiborne in D.C. We will cover his expenses. Tell him it's urgent, a favor to an old friend. Don't take no for an answer. No more emails until I get home. Marco. After a quick sandwich and a cola in Von Tissen's office, Joel Backman left the bank building riding shotgun in a shiny green BMW four-door sedan. For good measure, he kept a Swiss newspaper in front of his face until they were on the Autobahn. The driver was Franz. Franz fancied himself a Formula One hopeful, and when Joel let it be known that he was in somewhat of a hurry, Franz slipped into the left lane and hit 150 kilometers per hour. Chapter 32. At 1:55 p.m., Joel Backman was sitting in a lavishly large seat in the first-class section of a Lufthansa 747 as it began its pushback from the gate at Munich Airport. Only when it started to move did he dare pick up the glass of champagne he had been staring at for 10 minutes. The glass was empty by the time the plane stopped at the end of the runway for its final check. When the wheels lifted off the pavement, Joel closed his eyes and allowed himself the luxury of a few hours of relief. His son, on the other hand, and at exactly the same moment, 7:55 Eastern Standard Time, was stressed to the point of throwing things. How the hell was he supposed to go buy a new cell phone immediately, then call Carl Pratt again and solicit old favors that did not exist, and somehow cajole a retired and cantankerous old senator from Ocracoke, North Carolina, to drop what he was doing and return immediately to a city he evidently disliked immensely? Not to mention the obvious, he, Neil Backman, had a rather full day at the office. Nothing as pressing as rescuing his wayward father, but still a pretty full docket with clients and other important matters. He left Jerry's Java, but instead of going to the office, he went home. Lisa was bathing their daughter and was surprised to see him. "What's wrong?" she said. "We have to talk. Now." He began with the mysterious letter postmarked from York, Pennsylvania, and went through the $4,000 loan, as painful as it was, then the smartphone, the encrypted emails, pretty much the entire story. She took it calmly, much to his relief. "You should have told me," she said more than once. "Yes, and I'm sorry." There was no fight, no arguing. Loyalty was one of her strongest traits. And when she said, "We have to help him," Neil hugged her. "He'll pay back the money," he assured her. "We'll worry about the money later. Is he in danger?" "I think so." "Okay, what's the first step?" "Call the office and tell them I'm in bed with the flu." Their entire conversation was captured live and in perfect detail by a tiny mic planted by the Mossad in the light fixture above where they were sitting. It was wired to a transmitter hidden in their attic, and from there it was relayed to a high-frequency receiver a quarter of a mile away in a seldom-used retail office space recently leased for 6 months by a gentleman from D.C. There, a technician listened to it twice, then quickly emailed his field agent in the Israeli embassy in Washington. Since Backman's disappearance in Bologna more than 24 hours ago, the bugs planted around his son had been monitored even more closely. The email to Washington concluded with, "JB's coming home." Fortunately, Neil did not mention the name Giovanni Ferro during the conversation with Lisa. Unfortunately, he did mention two of the three hotels, the Marriott and the Sheraton. Backman's return was given the highest priority possible. 11 Mossad agents were located on the East Coast. All were ordered to D.C. immediately. Lisa dropped their daughter off at her mother's. Then she and Neil sped south to Charlottesville, 30 minutes away. In a shopping center north of town, they found the office for U.S. Cellular. They opened an account, bought a phone, and within 30 minutes were back on the road. Lisa drove while Neil tried to find Carl Pratt. Aided by generous helpings of champagne and wine,
Joel managed to sleep for several hours over the Atlantic. When the plane landed at JFK at 4:30 p.m., the relaxation was gone, replaced by uncertainties and a compulsion to look over his shoulder. At immigration, he at first stepped into line with the returning Americans, a much shorter line. The mob waiting across the way for non-U.S. was embarrassing. Then he caught himself, glanced around, began cursing under his breath, and hustled over to the foreigners. How stupid can you be? A thick-necked uniformed kid from the Bronx was yelling at people to follow this line, not that one, and hurry up while you're at it. Welcome to America. Some things he had not missed. The passport officer frowned at Giovanni's passport, but then he had frowned at all the others, too. Joel had been watching him carefully from behind a pair of cheap sunglasses.
Could you remove your sunglasses, please? The officer said.
Certamente, Joel said loudly, anxious to prove his Italianness. He took off the sunglasses, squinted as if blinded, then rubbed his eyes while the officer tried to study his face. Reluctantly, he stamped the passport and handed it over without a word. With nothing to declare, the customs officials barely looked at him. Joel hustled through the terminal and found the line at the taxi stand. Penn Station, he said. The driver resembled Farouk Khan, the youngest of the three, just a boy. And as Joel studied him from the back seat, he pulled his briefcase closer. Moving against the rush hour traffic, he was at Penn Station in 45 minutes. He bought an Amtrak ticket to D.C. and at 7 left New York for Washington. The taxi parked on Brandywine Street in Northwest Washington. It was almost 11, and most of the fine homes were dark. Backman spoke to the driver, who was already reclining and ready for a nap. Mrs. Pratt was in bed and struggling with sleep when she heard the doorbell. She grabbed her robe and hurried down the stairs. Her husband slept in the basement most nights, mainly because he snored, but also because he was drinking too much and suffering from insomnia. She presumed he was there now.
"Who is it?" she asked through the intercom.
"Joel Backman," came the answer, and she thought it was a prank.
"Who?"
"Donna, it's me, Joel, I swear. Open the door." She peeped through the hole in the door and did not recognize the stranger.
"Just a minute," she said,
then ran to the basement where Carl was watching the news. A minute later, he was at the door wearing a Duke sweatsuit and holding a pistol.
"Who is it?" he demanded through the intercom.
"Carl, it's me, Joel. Put the gun down and open the door." The voice was unmistakable. He opened the door and Joel Backman walked into his life, an old nightmare back for more. There were no hugs, handshakes, hardly a smile. The Pratts quietly examined him because he looked so different, much thinner, hair darker and shorter, strange clothing. He got a, "What are you doing here?" from Donna.
"That's a good question," he said coolly.
He had the advantage of planning. They were caught completely off guard.
"Will you put that gun down?"
Pratt put the gun on a side table.
"Have you talked to Neil?" Backman asked.
"All day long."
"What's going on, Carl?" Donna asked.
"I don't really know."
"Can we talk? That's why I'm here. I don't trust phones anymore."
"Talk about what?" she demanded.
"Could you make us some coffee, Donna?" Joel asked pleasantly.
"Hell no."
"Scratch the coffee." Carl had been rubbing his chin, assessing things.
"Donna, we need to talk in private. Old law firm stuff. I'll give you the rundown later."
She shot them both a look that clearly said, "Go straight to hell," then stomped back up the stairs. They stepped into the den. Carl said,
"Would you like something to drink?"
"Yes, something strong." He went to a small wet bar in a corner and poured single malts, doubles. He handed Joel a drink and, without the slightest effort at a smile, said,
"Cheers."
"Cheers. It's good to see you, Carl."
"I bet it is. You weren't supposed to see anyone for another 14 years.
Counting the days, huh?
We're still cleaning up after you, Joel. A bunch of good folks got hurt. I'm sorry if Donna and I aren't exactly thrilled to see you. I can't think of too many people in this town who'd like to give you a hug.
Most would like to shoot me.
Carl gave a wary look over at the pistol. I can't worry about that, Backman continued. Sure, I'd like to go back and change some things, but I don't have that luxury. I'm running for my life now, Carl, and I need some help. Maybe I don't want to get involved. I can't blame you, but I need a favor, a big one. Help me now, and I promise I'll never show up on your doorstep again. I'll shoot the next time. Where's Senator Claiborne? Tell me he's still alive.
Yes, very much so. And you caught some luck.
What?
He's here in D.C.
Why?
Hollis Maples is retiring, after 100 years in the Senate. They had a bash for him tonight. All the old boys are in town.
Maples? He was drooling in his soup 10 years ago.
Well, now he can't see his soup. He and Claiborne were as tight as ticks.
Have you talked to Claiborne?
Yes.
And?
It might be a tough one, Joel. He didn't like the sound of your name. Something about being shot for treason.
Whatever. Tell him he can broker a deal that will make him feel like a real patriot.
What's the deal?
I have the software, Carl. The whole package. Picked it up this morning from a vault in a bank in Zurich, where it's been sitting for more than 6 years. You and Claiborne come to my room in the morning, and I'll show it to you.
I really don't want to see it.
Yes, you do. Pratt sucked down 2 ounces of scotch. He walked back to the bar and refilled his glass, took another toxic dose, then said,
"When and where?"
The Marriott on 22nd Street, room 520, 9 in the morning.
Why, Joel? Why should I get involved?
A favor to an old friend.
I don't owe you any favors. And the old friend left a long time ago.
Please, Carl, bring in Claiborne and you'll be out of the picture by noon tomorrow. I promise you'll never see me again.
That is very tempting.